C1F. Number 7B.
Then at life, always when she comes to life, truth and love, she gets very human. She says, well, that perfection is acknowledged and won only by degrees, step by step. She says here that perfection is seen only in degrees, that the ages work slowly up to perfection. And how long it will take, no man knows, not even the Son, only the Father. But the goal will be won. See, always she comes in with life and says, all right, though this is a fact in being, I know that the human in man is not willing to give in so quickly. But so that it is seems to be a time process coming in. But that doesn't matter, because from the divine point of view, time is no concept. It's only a concept of the human. We have made time. God has not made time. Time is not a fact in being. In being there is no time. Being does not know time. We have defined humanly what time is and have measured it. And we have all sorts of times. We have the clock time, we have a biological time, we have a psychological time, we have all sorts of time concepts. We have to see that in psychology, time is something very different than in ordinary human life. In ordinary human life, time is that which we can measure according to the calendar and to the watch. In psychology, time becomes a very different thing, because in psychology you can see that the past can become present and the future can become present. So that the time concept there becomes different. Biology has another time concept, the biological time. You know that very well, that if you fly to the other end of the globe in one hop, that we can change our watch and adjust it to the time, but that our body does not adjust itself so quickly. It takes a few days to adjust to the new time, because the body seems to have its own time. Well, just see that time is a mortal concept. And that because we have that mortal concept, it seems that this that perfection is won only in degrees. As truth, she shows that truth, correcting and destroying sin and disease, is a revelation to all mankind. That Christ's mission was really a mission that would bless all mankind. One can't see Christ in divine science without blessing all mankind, because we can't separate God and man. That's just not possible anymore. That separation is a separation in belief, but not in fact. And we can't destroy facts. The fact in being is that God and man is one. That principle and idea is one. Therefore, what we understand about God, we understand about man. And if we therefore understand something about the Christ in divine science, we understand something about the whole humanity. And that was Christ's mission. Because he understood a lot about the Christ in divine science, he left an influence over 2,000 years and many years to come. A definite impress on all humanity. Think of the power there lies in spiritual things. No man in the field of physical science or of mathematical science or of any human science could ever leave such an impress on humanity as a spiritual scientist can, like Jesus. And this is the bigness of truth, capital T, compared with the truths which we think we can seek and understand. Then, lover's love at the end, the efficacy of truth on the sick is unquestionable. He says that this influence on the sick cannot be denied. Here she speaks, the counterfact relative to any disease is required to cure it. Well, this is the great tone of love. And I recapitulate it quickly in order to show what he wants to say here. For us, it's practical, operative Christianity for us, which says, if we understand that sin, sickness and death have no part in God, then we understand that it can have no part in man. That's the humanism of love. Why can it have no part in man? Because if I take the first subtone of mind, I see if I take the standpoint of divine mind, then the law of mortal mind is annulled, and with it the results of mortal mind. I begin to see all from the infinitude of the unfathomable mind, knowing only itself. That mind as spirit knows only good, never evil, therefore can make no situation which is evil and serves the purpose of good. Theology says that God is good, and in order to bring out the good in man, he makes him sick so that he awakes to the good, so that he awakes and seeks God. So they say that good can be, that evil can be a means, an educational means of good. Well, this is not reasonable, that good can use evil for the purpose of good. Good is good and remains good. And therefore the divine law of mind makes no law which demands evil or sickness or anything like that. Then as so it shows that therefore, because love is so and has its identity and its unchangeable identity, it is impossible for man to become sick. He can't get away from his high stature. He can't get away from perfection. Man cannot fall away from perfection. Man is not a fallen man. He remains what he is, man. So that, as principle, it is seen that disharmony cannot be part of man, because disharmony is no part of God, so it can't be part of men. And that this is really an eternal fact which we, mortally, may only achieve step by step, but that it will bless all mankind and that its effect is unquestionable. We don't have to doubt it. Well, that's the first part. Well, that gives me a whole hour for the next part. The next part is epitomized as the divinity of humanity. It's showing the same picture, just from another angle. Instead of showing that God has a humanism, it shows that the human has a divinity. It is perhaps that what the Old Testament was naming the remnant, always saying that whatever happens to Israel, how much will be destroyed in Israel, that there will be always a remnant, and that out of the remnant will come the salvation. In that way, we may consider ourselves mortals, but we are not wholly mortals. There is always a remnant. And that remnant is divine. And it is only a question that we appeal to the divine in us, to see that the divinity in the humanity, the divinity in us, is that remnant which can unfold and unfold and unfold. So, the subject, when one reads the chapter, is showing at once a great change at this point. You feel, reading the text, that suddenly in the forefront of the discussion in her pages is the human sense of the divine. The first subject, mind, shows that human thought must be permeated by the divine. Can you see how now she goes out from the human thought and showing that the human thought is not the mortal thought, and that the human thought is able to be permeated by the divine mind, and that we can make use of the very highest, of the very best, through human thinking? Because human thought is that, compared with the animals, that is able to free itself from the animal instincts, from the body consciousness, and can consider abstract, divine ideas. That separates man from the animal. Physiologically, man is practically the same as the animal. The physiologists tell us that since the appearance of man, which is about a million years ago, that the physiological structure has hardly changed anymore. That's a great surprise for them, because they see that in all other forms of living creatures, that these living creatures go through many physiological mutations, that they develop over hundreds of thousands of years into new forms, very different forms, but that interestingly enough, that the moment that creature which we call a mortal appeared, that physiologically he has hardly changed. And that at that point it was really the spirit of man that evolved. That's the theory that as well Dunuy, as well as Teilhard de Chardin, and I think most of the new evolutionists support, that the great enigma of man is that he evolves spiritually and no more physically. And that which separates, as I said, man from the animals is that he can think. And that he can think independent of his body. He is no more the slave of his instincts. He can think against his body, against the ancestral instincts. He can think in new forms, and he can subjugate himself to a superhuman principle. Whereas the animal can't. The animal must obey the biological principle. He is the slave of his instincts and of his body. So here is the great chance that we use the divinity in humanity by controlling thought and channelizing thought into the right direction, towards the divine mind. The subject of mind is built up very easily, and I can just go through it rather quickly. First, she shows that spiritual drafts heal and inspire the human family. So that spiritual thoughts are those thoughts that inspire the human family. That spiritual thinking is divine power. That it has in itself a hue of divinity, and therefore the force and power to heal and save mankind. A spirit, therefore, comes to demand to be familiar with good, purifies mortal mind, and empties it of sin and disease. It is that which we have been told, I think, from the days of Sunday school, if one has gone to Sunday school, or anyway from the early stages of Christian Science. Watch your thought, see if your thoughts are aligned to God's nature, and watch that they are pure, because in the measure as they are pure, they will help and heal. It is a constant watching and guarding ourselves against false belief. Keep ward, she says, proper ward over mortal mind, clearing out the brutes of evil, empty mortal mind of sin and sickness. You can just see how first we have to see that thoughts can be aligned to God's nature. In order to do that, we have a spirit separate between evil thoughts and good thoughts, and see that we watch our thoughts so that they are always directed and channelized towards divine mind. Then a soul, she says, then we can control evil thoughts. I said here, the control of evil thoughts is a strong defense against their effects. Soul controls. So if we can control thought, we can control the evil effects flowing from those evil thoughts. She says here, control evil thoughts, because if you don't, they will control you. See, they will control you. It's that point where we are constantly deciding, are we an animal or are we a divine creature? If we don't watch and make use of that human faculty of being able to control our thoughts, if we don't watch, then the animal instinct will take the upper hand and control us, just as it does the animal. Therefore, as principle, she appeals to all those human offices in the world which have to do with the education and guidance of thought. In principle, it is that she appeals to the teachers and educators. I have put here, pure and uplifting thoughts of educators achieve more than does a debased and unscrupulous mind of mere scholarly attainment. That education is the duty of teachers, and that teachers should be aware what atmosphere they convey to the students. If it's only an atmosphere of pure, cold intellect and scholarly attainment, or if they are able to convey the atmosphere of a real cultured mind, of a humanistic mind, and that does much more for mankind at the long run than all the intellectual labors or education. But therefore, academic education must not be one-sided, not just on the side of learning, but that it must also see that it cultures man, not only knowledge. In life, she would appeal to those who have to do with life, namely to the doctors. Physicians should transmit to their patients the certainty of the perpetuity of being. She talks here how doctors should give or should deal with their patients so that they transmit to the patients the certainty of the continuity of life, of the strength of life, of the newness of life, giving hope, giving assurance, and so on. You see, again, it's permeating thought with the divine. In truth, she appeals to another class of people, to the clergymen, and she says, clergymen and leaders should uplift the standard of truth in the interest of mankind, so as to broaden its concept and raise it spiritually. She sees that clergymen and leaders are leading mankind, and therefore that their duty is, through their thinking, through their teaching, through their preaching, to uplift the standard of truth, to raise the hearer spiritually, she says here, and that they shouldn't misuse their position just for their own glorification, for professional reputation. So it is so easy for a professor or for a clergyman or for a leader or for a politician to do that which brings him most popularity, no matter if he is honest to himself and true to himself. And that's the danger. People who stand in the limelight for the world must have that quality of true leaders, namely to be true to themselves and to the truth, as far as they know it. As love, she takes another educator, namely the mother, as she would in love, and show that a mother, thought, should take their models from the divine mind, that the mother is the strongest educator. I think we all believe in that. Somehow we feel that that which mother has given us, the example that mother has given us, the atmosphere that mother has given us, the tenderness that mother has given us, the patience, the certainty that mother has shown towards us, all that seems to mold our whole character more than anything else, more than teachers and preachers and lecturers and so on. A mother, a real mother, is really a wonderful thing. One never forgets it one's whole life. You just can't do something wrong because you had a mother. It's a sign of love. The sign, as she says here, it's love who always goes out from the divine mind, and not from a human mind. And it's the strongest educator one can have. It must be a wonderful thing to be a mother and to have the opportunity to convey that. Because love as mind is that which only sees perfection, no matter what happened, no matter what the situation was. And it gives such an impress that the mother doesn't have to preach very much to the child. Not a bit. Yes, just to be a mother. And that teaches books and books and books. It's a wonderful thing. And naturally, more and more, we will see that each one of us is mother. So, here in mind, one can see the beauty of using that remnant which is left, or which is perhaps given from the divine to the human. And see that if we nurture that divine in us, that has the power of God within itself. So that touch of divine thought is not the power of our thought. It's always the power of the infinite, that the least idea we touch in thought, if it is an idea, it has the whole magnitude of God. It is embedded and encircled with the whole magnitude of God. And that makes one realize how big we really are, if we see it properly. Because we are not an animal, but can think, and because we can control that thinking and focus it into the divine mind, that focusing into the divine mind clothes that whole thought with the whole of mind, with the whole of God. And so every thought that is in the right direction is God working. That second part here doesn't want to show how we as humans outside of divinity make now footsteps in order to get into the divine. It shows that there are remnants within in each one of us, whoever it is, that there are remnants in there, and those remnants are God Himself, and not just human nice bits with which we can work up to God, but they are God itself. And that gives us the power and the certainty and the beauty of being.